A logo appears in bold slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now in a black and white film, the letters WB appear in a shield, and the inscription Warner Brothers Pictures Incorporated, Jack L. Warner Executive Producer, presents. A steamboat's paddle wheel churns on a river. A title, The Adventures of Mark Twain. Starring Frederick March as Mark Twain, Alexis Smith as Libby Langdon, with Donald Crisp, Alan Hale, C. Aubrey Smith, John Carradine, Bill Henry, Robert Barat, Walter Hampton, Joyce Reynolds, Whitford Kane, Percy Kilbride, Nana Bryant, screenplay by Alan LeMay. Adopted by Alan LeMay and Harold M. Sherman. Additional dialogue, Harry Chandler. Associate producer, Julius Evans. Director of photography, Saul Pulido, ASC. Dialogue director, Herschel Daugherty. Film editor, Ralph Dawson. Art director, John Hughes. Musical director, Leo F. Forbstein. Produced by Jesse L. Lasky. Music by Max Steiner. Directed by Irving Rapper. This film has been described by Descriptive Video Service, a division of the Media Access Group at WGBH, with funding by the U.S. Department of Education. Described by Dutch Priest. Read by Pat Lentz. A comet and its bright tail blaze in a starry sky. Below, a group of people gathered on a riverbank gaze up with wonder. Two black women with their hair tied up in scarves stand with a little boy. Another boy gapes upward as a woman speaks.
Great day in the morning.
Have mercy on the cut. Hallie's coming. Hallie's coming, what they calls the name.
Hallie, who's she?
Hallie's the man what conjured it up there, I reckon.
Hallie doesn't see it first.
Judge Clemens, how do we know that that thing won't set the world on fire?
Know about it because it comes back every 75 years. Think of it as kind of a jubilee in heaven.
Like a possum hunt?
Well, kind of like a camp meeting in heaven.
Judge Clemens! Come quick! They want you down home! It's done happened!
The tall, mustached judge hurries off behind the stocky black messenger, later in a bedroom.
Jane, darling.
He kisses a woman in bed.
John, it's a boy.
A boy.
An elderly midwife hands the judge an infant.
Well, sir, this is the night.
A maid looks on.
Can you see that other comet, son?
Reckon that big comet must have come out just the very minute this child was born. Like as if it brung him from somewhere clean out of the world.
I suppose people all over the country are looking at that comet tonight. And not one soul of them has ever heard of little Samuel Langhorne Clemens.
Young man, that's you.
Now words appear over the Clemens weather-beaten house. Here, November 30th, 1835, began The Adventures of Mark Twain. A ghostly finger follows handwriting.
Persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot will be shot.
The hand picks up a pen and signs.
By order of Mark Twain.
A white-haired man in a bow tie and white suit appears in a cloudy sky.
That is me you just saw a little bit ago. I came a little ahead of schedule. Maybe that was due to the comet. When I arrived, I hadn't any hair, I hadn't any teeth, I hadn't any clothes. But it was all right then, because I didn't know that I should have been embarrassed. I've learned since, to my sorrow, that man is the only animal that blushes, or needs to.
He lights a cigar.
In fact, I blush a little now as I look back. Some things man doesn't like to tell about himself unless he gets beyond the grave, as they say. But now I can tell the truth, the whole truth, and, well, that is, within limits. You see, truth is a very valuable thing. I believe we should be a little economical with it. Well, I was born under the comet. Now, that's the truth. And I grew up in a village of Hannibal, Missouri. That's the truth. I think the village contained 100 people, and I increased the population by 1%. That's more than some of the best men in history have done for a town. Life unfolded gently there, and the Mississippi was more important than the seven seas. Right in the middle of it was Jackson's Island. It was the lair of as bloodthirsty a band of pirates as ever scuttled a ship. There was Tom, the terror of the seas.
A blonde boy.
And Huckleberry the red-handed.
A freckle-faced boy.
And our slave boy, Jim, the avenger of the Picaroons.
A black boy.
And here were built the long, low luggers that plowed the Spanish Main. The others supplied the labor, and I supplied the imagination.
Young Samuel fishes. Another raft passes.
Hurry, man, hurry!
What you calling us for?
Those buccaneers will beat us to the treasure.
They ain't nothing but white trash on a raft.
That's Captain Kidd and his pirates in disguise.
What?
Jim slides off his hat.
Like the doggone thing, he going on where Master Sam is at.
He scratches his head.
We rescued many a beauteous maiden and made many a villain walk the plank. And, of course, we gave our spoils to the poor.
A steamboat rounds a bend near the boys' raft.
It's a galleon, men! Get ready to board her!
Master Sam, you know we can't get aboard that steamboat. And if we does, they're gonna fling us off.
But pirating was only secondary. It was the river that held us. The broad, majestic river with its lazy current and its soft, cool mud. Its steamboats were our dreams of luxury, and their pilots were our gods.
Gosh, fellas, the big Missouri! And look at the pilot up there, running the whole business. Oh, oh!
As the steamboat paddles closer, its wake jostles the tiny raft. The four boys struggle to keep afloat as a dog waits idly. The raft splits in two, and the boys lose their balance. First, Sam tumbles into the river, then Jim, then Huck, and Tom. Now, Sam sneaks home with his dog.
I clung to the river until the last precious moment of the day. Then I had to give up my life of crime and go home. I used to shinny up the porch roof and in a window. I got so I could do it in record time. I suppose most boys have tried to fool their mothers. I used to try to fool mine.
Sam throws on a nightshirt, hops in bed, and pulls a blanket over his head. A woman enters with a tray of food.
Sam.
She sets down the tray.
Sam, you needn't play possum. I heard you coming in.
She yanks away the blankets. Sam rubs his eyes sleepily.
Time to get up, Ma?
You know perfectly well I ought to tan you, Sam Clemens.
She fluffs his pillow.
You realize that for four lifelong hours, I haven't known whether you were alive or drowned.
Oh, Ma, I'll never get drowned.
Well, I reckon it's just because you were born to hang, like all that other river riffraff.
Nothing ever happens around this old town, except on the river.
The river. I wish I'd never heard of that river. Once that Mississippi mud gets into you, Sam, it never gets out.
Sam eats.
Not all that's left of me in this life is try to make you into a fine, cultured man. Looked up to and respected like your father was. But I reckon that river's too much for me.
Gosh, Ma.
Why don't you try once more to help Orion in the print shop? Just during your vacation so you'll stay out of trouble.
She strokes his head.
Won't you try, son? And maybe someday you'll learn to be a printer.
Sam chews his food.
All right, Ma. I'll try.
He nibbles at some meat and feeds a piece to his dog. Now lettering on a windowpane reads, Hannibal Journal, Printing.
After 3 years in that print shop, I was ready to change places with a convict and pay him a bonus.
Inside, teenage Sam works at a table.
My brother Orion was more discouraged.
Shh, quiet, Rock.
Sam.
Now what have I done?
Oh, my stars almighty, it does seem to me that the past 3 years here would have taught you to do something right. Seth Peters paid his subscription this week with 2 bushels of large yellow bears. Pears, you dunce, not bears.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
Sam glances over at Orion, then tugs on a string that stretches out a window. At the other end on the sidewalk, a kitten plays with the ball of string. Outside, townspeople race down the street. A man steers his horse-drawn wagon. A boy stops at the printing office's window. Sam knocks over his box of finished typeface.
Well, I guess you're not in much of a hurry. There's 7 hours work on that floor, you dunderhead.
Sam crouches over the scattered type.
If only somebody invented a machine that would set type by itself, he'd make $10 million, and I'd pay half.
A mustached man storms into the office, a newspaper in his hand.
I won't stand this.
Well, I'm sure I don't understand, Mr. Higgins.
Look at that.
Orion reads.
Last Tuesday, Mr. Higgins, editor of the Bugle, outstood as a hero when he single-handed rescued hisself from drowning hisself. Why, I never saw... His sweetheart left him high and dry, so he waded out in the river to end his sorrows. When his sounding showed he could not get drowned without getting in over his head, he turned around and waded out and is in our midst again.
This is serious. Fighting serious.
Mr. Higgins, sir, I swear I never set eyes on that item before in my...
Do you mean to say...
Orion turns to Sam, then stalks forward. Sam looks around nervously, then somersaults out the window. His dog leaps out after him. Orion and an elderly worker watch as Sam runs off. Now fingers pin a handwritten note to a pillowcase. It reads, "It ain't I don't love you, Ma, but I just gotta try the river, because I won't ever be happy in my life if I don't. Your obedient and faithful son, Sam." Now at his mother's bedside, Sam lifts his fingers from her pillow, then gazes at her sleeping form. With tear-stained cheeks, Sam kisses her on the forehead, then slowly backs away and turns to go. Now black smoke billows from a steamboat's twin stacks. The words Paul Jones are printed on its hull.
Holy sovereignty, Hospital! Taking you by and large, Sam Clemens, you do seem to be more different kinds of an ass than I ever saw before. Why I ever took you aboard beats me.
Sam turns the ship's wheel.
Where are you taking her now?
I wished I was dead.
He cranks the wheel starboard.
There's one thing you've got to have, Sam Clemens, if you're going to be a river pilot. And that's a memory. You can't think you know this river. You've got to know you know it.
The teacher spits.
Yes, sir.
Sam spits, and his teacher glares. The Paul Jones glides onward.
That's Angel's Point over yonder.
They both spit. The pipe-smoking teacher scowls.
That's shoal water at that cottonwood. That's the Harrison plantation on that bluff.
They spit again.
Stop that!
Yes, sir.
A double-decker steamboat speeds down the river. Now a crewman tosses a plumb line off the bow, then pulls it back up. He turns to the pilots.
Waterless twain!
Look out, look out. Don't hug that slick place. There ain't 6 feet there. She won't stand it. She begins to smell it. Look sharp, I tell you!
7 feet!
The crewman ducks under a tree branch.
Look out, look out!
Sam turns the wheel and the boat moves just feet from the bank. Now the huge wheel lifts Sam up.
Oh, blazes, there you go! Clip it up! Snatch her! Snatch her!
The teacher talks into a speaker tube as Sam struggles on the wheel.
Set her back! Let go of that whistle cord! What are you doing up there?
He pulls Sam down off the wheel, then steers the boat clear of a river island. Now the pilot yanks several bell cords.
You remember what I told you about those bluff reefs? What did I say?
I don't know, sir.
You don't know? Look here, now, why do you think I told you all that stuff?
To be entertaining, I thought, sir.
To be... Get out of this pilot house. Get off this boat. Dive overboard. Shoot yourself. Anything but get out of here before you sink us all.
As Sam shuffles towards the cabin door, the pilot glances over.
Come back here.
Sam turns. Blinking back tears, he takes his place at the wheel beside the pilot, who puffs his corncob pipe.
I said I'd learn you the river, and when I tell a man I'll learn him the river, I'll learn him if it kills him. Take the wheel.
As Sam eyes him, the pilot steps back.
Take it.
Sam's eyes glisten with tears as he grips the wheel handles. The pilot looks over Sam's shoulder.
Hold her steady now. She'll pull through.
At the bow, the crewman lifts the plumb line and checks the measure.
Mark Twain, save water.
Well, there's one call you'll never forget so long as you live, boy. Mark Twain. Safe water. Many a night of storm and fog when you're trying to go on through, you'll be straining your ears to hear that call. Welcome a sound in all the world to a river man as those two words. Mark Twain.
The pilot rests his hand on Sam's shoulder, and Sam's eyes brim with tears. Now the sun sits low behind the paddling boat.
I've remembered Bixby all these years. I don't see why he didn't drown me. He must have been a good teacher, because after a while, I was a pilot. And I was beginning what I suppose a man must call his is real life.
Now a steamboat's hull reads Queen of Dixie. On board, a group of minstrels in blackface and frizzy wigs perform for fancy-dressed gamblers in the boat's casino. Two minstrels dance with tambourines. Nearby, an ornate plaque on a door reads Samuel L. Clemens, Chief Pilot. The door opens and an adult mustached Sam emerges, wearing a dark suit and cap, plaid vest and flouncy cravat. He puts on a pair of white gloves as he walks out into the smoky room.
Sam! Mr. Clemens.
A man shows Sam a rock.
Now, here's the thing. You take this rock sample. I've been trying
to... The 100th time.
No, this is a different kind of rock. Look, Clemens, if I didn't think so much of you, I wouldn't try and argue you into this.
Steve Gillis, why don't you try to do right? It'd please an awful lot of people and astonish the rest. This rock's no good. It's got a rotten streak in it.
Why, that's silver, you jughead.
It is?
Sure, the mountains is just busting with it. So why should you go to see it on the river when you could go out west and get rich?
Sam returns it.
Steve, it isn't that I don't believe you, but what does a river pilot want with a million?
I'm telling you, a man wouldn't know this river lately.
Yes. Yankees rushing west.
I don't suppose a man lives that can stand prosperity. Other people's, I mean.
And 50,000 longhorns by way of the cross timbers.
All down and around she goes. Why, the whole town is built on a mountain of silver.
If you don't do this, you'll regret it all the rest of your life. Now, I know you're going to be with me, so I'll get the assayer's report, and that will prove it.
All right, gentlemen, keep your eye on the ace of spades.
A dealer lays an ace and two queens face down.
Gentlemen, who wants to try?
A gambler winks and wagers some coins.
I take this one.
The gambler turns the card over. It's the queen of hearts.
Sorry, now watch closely. It's all very simple.
Incredible, preventing themselves to be robbed like that.
A shifty-eyed man jostles an onlooker.
Sorry.
As the shifty-eyed man leaves, Sam stops
him. If you don't succeed, you fell off.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Come on, quick.
The man empties a pocket and hands Sam the contents.
Now the rest of it.
The pickpocket produces more from another pocket as another pilot arrives.
Can I help you, Mr. Clemens?
Too bad we haven't got a cure for this fellow's manners. Maybe drowning will help.
Well, that's cast off.
Sam faces the onlooker.
Ain't these yours?
What? Why, yes, I believe they are.
Oh, here's something else.
Thank you. I think that's mine also.
It's a small framed portrait of a young woman.
I suppose she's your,
My sister.
Good. I mean, of course. Of course. Glad to have met you, sir.
Well, thank you, sir. Oh, Mr. Clemens.
He tucks the portrait in a pocket.
Oh, Mr. Clemens.
Yes, sir?
Well, I'm indebted to you. My name's Charles Langdon.
Langdon. Have you ever been to Pilot House? Well, come up later. I'm, going to give the boys a little surprise.
Surprise?
Old shellbacks around here that jump off this boat if they knew it was ahead of
them. Sam edges close and points at Langdon's pocket.
Can I see that again?
I beg your pardon?
Nothing. Just let it go.
Change your luck to the other tiger. Step right up and around she goes.
As the Wheel of Fortune spins, the Queen of Dixie advances through the foggy night. Now Langdon stands next to Sam at the ship's wheel.
Passenger in the pilot house is kind of special. Those are pilots back there, not on duty. They're just studying the river.
This fog's getting thicker and thicker.
Should've Nearby, five men watch as Sam steers.
If he's dead set to wreck her, I want to see it from up here on account of the view.
You think your sister would be interested
Do pilots have to study?
Well, we never do anything else. This river takes up all our time. How old you say your sister was?
One pilot steps forward.
Tells me you're going to tie up short of Hat Island.
You bet your gizzard he's going to tie up. You think he wants to knock the steamboat's brains out?
I got to pick up 80 tons of buffalo hide in St. Joe.
You do.
No pilot ever run Hat Island, the fog, and no pilot ever will. Now you get out of here.
Torches hang from poles on the boat's bow. The captain watches a crewman drop a plumb line.
Pretty bad, Mr. Clemens. I think we'd better tie up.
I'll tell you when I want to tie up. Put out those torch baskets!
The captain turns.
Put out those torch baskets!
Turn on them fires! Get that light out! Hurry, jump off!
A worker puts down a trunk, then a bucket on a rope down into the river and draws some water. He raises the bucket, then douses the fires in a hanging torch basket. Others lower shades on windows. As the boat moves through a thick fog, Sam glances over at Langdon.
I suppose in the case of a girl like your sister...
It's getting pretty hard to see the river, isn't it?
No. The trick is to guess which is the wet part.
It seems wide enough.
Sure, it's full mile wide on the surface. Underneath, it's one long mass of shoals and bars and snags for 1,200 miles of river. You have to know where each one of them is within a couple of feet, and they can change position overnight. You can't think you know this river. You gotta know you know it.
Sam's teacher, Bixby, winks.
Learn 1,200 miles of river.
This is the first time in 7 years Sam Clemens has told the plain, undecorated truth, and that young fellow doesn't believe a word he says.
You mean you never heard of these things?
Well, you'll have to forgive my ignorance, Mr. Clemens, but I'm afraid there are millions of people who know even less about it than I do.
I never took no stock in the notion that people wasn't the same everywhere. We all speak the same language.
Sam swings the wheel as a small houseboat comes into view. The scraggy houseboater moves the tiller, a steering pole, Sam spins the wheel. The steamboat sideswipes the small vessel, knocking the houseboater down. He shakes his fist.
You trifling dunderheaded, free-brained river hog!
Oh, you ornery numbskullious rapscallion mudcat rasping? Serves you right. Put a light on that worm-eating brush pile, so a man can see you overnight.
Sam scowls and Langdon grins.
What was I saying about language?
Sam glances back over his shoulder.
I notice you keep looking back.
Oh, that? Well, that's on account of the alligators.
Langdon's brow furrows.
Alligators?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you run into them.
No. They grab onto the stern of the boat. If there's one thing an alligator loves better than another thing, it's to hitch a ride.
Hitch a ride?
Huh? Of course, just a few alligators hanging on behind aren't so bad.
The other pilots listen with interest.
But then the next alligator grabs onto the first one's tail, and then another one grabs onto him until you're pulling a whole chain of alligators.
You've really seen this thing?
Nearly every trip. Why, I've struggled up this river dragging a mass of alligators nearly a mile long and 10 alligators wide.
Really?
All the whop and overgrown lies I've ever heard in my life, and that the young fellow believes.
Thank heaven there's the foot of Head Island. He'll have to tie you.
I couldn't have stood no more. Sam, see you below in the Texas.
Aye, Cap.
The pilots head off. A crewman throws another plumb line into the water and cups his hand to his mouth.
Up, Tari, on the starboard.
Another crewman turns.
Mark Tari! On the stop!
Bixby and another pilot stare into the fog.
Wait, ain't he gone past his landing?
Do you suppose any man alive is fool enough to run Hat Island in this suit?
The two head for the pilot house. Sam leans towards the speaker tube.
Stand by below.
He peers into the fog. A crewman pulls up the plumb bob.
Oh, Hatwin, Lord
Dixie floats slowly through the dense fog. It passes a few feet from a riverbank lined with scraggly trees. At the wheel, Sam stares intently ahead. Beads of sweat glimmer on his face as he turns the large wheel. While Sam steers, Bixby and a pilot watch from behind.
Call Bixby and the others. They ain't never seen nothing like this and never will again.
Jubal, pile up ahead of steam down there. I'm gonna want everything you got.
We've tied the safety valve down now, sir.
What?
If this gauge goes any higher, I don't want to be looking at it.
Well, hang your hat on the gauge.
In the boiler room, Dibble eyes the needle on the gauge. Shirtless men slide firewood into a boiler.
It blows up on a railroad, there you is. It blows up on a steamboat, where is you?
On deck, the pilots gather.
You'll never make it.
You're the man that taught it.
I didn't teach him this.
As the steamboat pushes steadily on, Bixby approaches Sam.
Sam, you'll never get her through.
Then I'll take her half through twice.
The crewman draws up another line.
What a last twin starboard!
What a last twin starboard!
Stand by. Get ready now.
Dibble eyes the gauge.
I hope he knows what he's doing.
On the river, the riverboat edges past leafless trees in the shallow water. On deck, the pilots watch.
I've run this river nigh on 20 years, Captain. I never saw a man try this.
As the boat skims close to shore, Sam surveys from the wheel. One pilot gapes.
Halfway on the starboard. By George, a stern is coming down just exactly right.
The pilots all stand behind Sam.
It's over the first reef.
7 feet starboard.
7 feet starboard.
Sam's gaze is fixed ahead.
6 feet.
6 feet, Abbott!
She's growing a scant 6 feet.
She's feeling it now.
We'll never make it.
As the steamboat barrels on, shabbily dressed black passengers gather on a deck, their gaze fixed on its progress. On another deck, finely clad white passengers gather on a staircase.
7 feet starboard!
7 feet starboard!
The passengers watch with stony vigilance.
6 feet larboard!
6 feet larboard!
Passengers stare out at the river as the fog swirls by.
Rounding larboard! Rounding!
The Queen of Dixie lurches and slows. Its port paddle wheel mills up weeds and mud along the riverbank, then stops.
Tell her, have it. Every ounce you got.
The paddle wheel churns in place. Then the steamboat creeps forward and continues on its course through the shallow waters. Black smoke from the steamboat's twin stacks mix with the dense fog as the Queen of Dixie moves forward. Skirts another patch of grassy mud. Steadily cranking round, the paddle wheel heaves the massive boat forward. The pilots glance from Sam to the river.
Lower hard down.
Snatcher!
Bixby helps Sam force the ship's wheel. He puts his weight on the handles and bears his foot down on the spokes. The steamboat turns sharp. The pilots behind Sam stare as he maneuvers the wheel. On the lower deck, the crewman casts out the plumb line and pulls it back. He reads the measure and grins.
Mark Twain, save water. Oh, Mark Twain.
The pilots smile and cluster around Sam.
Great work, Sam!
Beautiful job, Sam.
I never expected to see that.
Sam Clemens never did anything like he was expected to in his life.
Below, a black passenger smiles.
The old Mississippi, dumbfound your boss. The pilot is a mighty man.
The pilot is a mighty man.
The pilot is a mighty man.
The fog was thick like the river mud. The pilot made his plea. Let me drive this boat like Noah did when the ark
the black passengers
sea.
Clap their hands and dance below deck. Sam stares wistfully into the foggy night. His eyes glisten with tears. Morning. Inside his cabin, Langdon packs his bag.
I never saw such thick weather in my life. The other pilots are saying it was the most... What do you people call it? Oh, lightning bit of piloting ever seen on the river.
I'm glad it suited him. Because that was my last run.
It was your what?
I'm leaving the river.
Sam stares at the portrait.
You're joking.
Well, yes, tis a joke in a way. All my life, everybody's been trying to tell me this river was only a wet streak in the dirt.
Wet streak?
Yeah, my parents, my brother, everybody. They broke their hearts trying to tell me. Oh, no, I wouldn't listen.
Clemens, if ever I saw a man well-fitted for his job and perfectly happy in that job, you were he.
Well, there's nothing in the world happier than a frog in the mud. But you know, a frog can only see about 8 feet.
He folds his hands behind his head.
I wonder what would happen if a frog saw a star.
Langdon blinks thoughtfully.
You'd kill him, Raleigh. He'd need a drink, probably.
Langdon pours two drinks. Sam gazes at the portrait.
I didn't realize there was anything a riverman could never have.
He stares off.
It'll take time. I'll need money.
His eyes light up.
I'll head west first. They're building a whole new country out there, Langdon. I'm going to have a crack at it.
Well, of all the... I can't imagine what's come over you.
He hands Sam a drink.
I'll tell you, but you won't believe me. Wouldn't be possible for you to believe me.
Yes.
See that picture of your sister there, Langdon?
Yes.
That's the girl I'm going to marry.
Langdon smiles as they click glasses. He does a double take and his smile fades. A sign on a dock reads, St. Genevieve. On a waterfront, stevedores at work stack barrels and boxes, and a shirtless worker lugs a bag. Now in his cabin's bathroom, Langdon lathers his face, then sharpens a straight razor on a strap. As he leans close to a mirror and shaves, a long branch holding a note bobs through the window. The The branch lowers the handwritten note onto the countertop next to the portrait of Langdon's sister and hooks the picture by its brass ring. The pole then lifts the picture away and glides back out the window. The note reads, "Dear Charles, if you are angry, count four. If you are awful angry, swear. Sam, P.S. I'm heading west." Drawn by two teams of horses, crosses a prairie. Inside, Sam rides with a portly mustached man. The horses gallop the coach through rocky foothills. Later, high in the mountains, a haggard Sam trudges with a pack over his shoulder. A mule follows. The mule is laden with supplies. The mustached passenger carries a spade and other gear. He exchanges a look with Sam, then pats the mule.
We're almost there. Come on, Beulah.
Now the mule, Beulah, lies down in the road while Sam's friend pushes her from behind.
Beulah, come on, do as I ask you. Come on, Beulah.
Wearing rough-hewn work clothes and boots, Beulah. Sam sits on a rock.
Hoist her on the larboard, Steve. She's hard-grounded.
Steve pushes Beulah's haunches, then he moves in front of her.
I'm gonna learn you.
That reef's got her amidships.
Beulah. Beulah, now don't aggravate me.
As Steve tugs Beulah's rope, the mule pulls back. Steve loses his grip and falls on his backside.
It's no use, Steve. She's took root worse than the Jeff Davis Democrat.
Yeah, we might as well locate here.
Yeah.
That looks like a creek bottom there, so you might just well start hauling water.
What for?
We gotta wash the gold out of this gravel, you lunkhead.
He hands Sam a bucket.
Too bad Beulah didn't balk where we could have flumed the water. We'll need about 1 million gallons. A million?
Sam dumps the bucket and glares at Beulah.
Why, you rapscallion, flea-brained, numbskull, you dunder-headed, dust-eating, gully-hopping, pot-walloping...
The mule springs to her feet, then marches off. Her long tail switches from side to side. Steve gapes. Sam tucks his thumbs in his belt.
Mississippi methods. They work, too.
Yeah.
The two men stoop to pick up their gear, and Beulah sits.
For a minute.
Steve and Sam share a sour look and toss their gear back down. They sit back to back on a rock. Later, a wooden, hand-painted sign reads, "Queen of Dixie Silver or Gold Mine, formerly Jackass Hill." The sign stands picketed in some rocks. Sam labors with a shovel in a deep hole. He pitches out a heap of sand, and the sand rains back over him. Steve jiggles an iron pan filled with gravel and stares at its contents.
I sure think we're coming to something, Sam.
Sam scoops up more rocky soil and slings it up. He bends to continue, and it tumbles back onto him. He throws down the shovel and grabs a pick. On the second thrust of the pick, the earth collapses under him. He drops 10 feet into a mine shaft. Above, Steve turns.
Sam!
Steve rushes over.
Hey, Steve! Steve, I can't find it!
Sam fumbles about in the shaft's dirty floor. He finds the picture frame and wipes the glass clean with his handkerchief.
What in the name of time are you doing down there?
I'm getting rich out west.
Steve fetches a coil of rope and tosses one end of it down to Sam.
Here, take this.
Well, I found out what a mine is, anyway. It's a hole in the ground with a darn fool at the end of it.
Using the rope, Sam climbs up.
It's an old tunnel runs right onto here. Well, maybe we could dig our way around it.
What's an abandoned tunnel doing there if there's any gold?
They missed the paving, that's all.
Yeah, well, I'm finished, that's all.
Oh, no, Sam. Let's pan just one more.
Oh?
That last pan showed awful good color.
No.
Now, don't get so previous, Sam. We might strike at any minute.
No.
Sam kicks aside a bucket with Steve's pan on it.
Why are you so stubborn? What'd we come here for, anyway? I'd never showed up here if I knew there wasn't something here.
As the two men walk off, sunlight reflects off dozens of glistening nuggets in the discarded pan. Now, the two men carry their packs into town. Beulah follows.
You realize we're broke?
Yep.
No grub, no place to sleep?
Yep.
All on earth I'm trying to do is to herd together enough money to go east in decent style. Girl isn't going to wait forever, you know, without seeing me, at least. You sure that'd help?
Now a cashier weighs gold nuggets.
$240.
On the street, a vendor talks with a cowboy. Sam and Steve walk on.
Steve, it beats me how anybody can avoid getting rich in this country. People that came here 3 weeks ago are rich now. We get worse off by the minute.
He sold his entrance for $10,000.
Can't we go back and give the mine another try?
No.
Oh, just one more pail of water.
No!
A man on horseback shoots a man on foot. Sam and Steve watch from behind a wagon.
I sure go fast here.
Poor feller works for the newspaper.
Take your opinions with you.
Wait the shooter after. Flings a newspaper at the dead man.
And right to print the facts.
Maybe you want to step into his shoes.
I didn't see nothing, Mr. Lee.
Then stand back.
As Lee rides off, the crowd moves in around the dead reporter. Sam leans toward another onlooker.
Where is that newspaper office?
In there.
Sam and Steve cross the street. Steve waits outside as Sam enters. A sign reads, "The Virginia City Enterprise, more news than some people can stand." Inside, a worker carries in a tray of type.
We'll set it out in bold type. Just under the Enterprise. And Billy's, that headline...
The newspaper man notices Sam.
Who are you?
Sam Clemens is my name. I'm your new reporter.
Joe Goodman's my name, and I got a reporter.
Didn't you hear that gunfire just now? You had a reporter.
Was that Daly? They got him, too.
Sam sits at a desk and picks up a quill pen.
What are you doing now?
If there's one man in this town so helpless or so low down that he can't speak his own mind, print it if he wants to, this country is done. I'm writing an account of how that man died, and it's going to curl somebody's hair.
Good.
Now a printer shows Sam a page.
That better, Sam?
Yeah, that's fine, Billings. Now set her up.
Sam?
Yeah?
Sam, where are we going to get a frog?
Frog? Billings, you got a frog?
What in time you want a frog for?
Well, Bret Hart over at Angel's Camp's got a frog.
Well, go borrow his frog. Let me work.
And he'll bet you every cent he's got his frog can outjump any frog in this country. Don't you see what a chance it is?
Nah. Now, you're a Mississippi frog expert. We ride over to Angel's Camp and you pick us up a frog that'll lay it all over his frog. We get odds of 10 to 1 and bet every cent we've got.
We got?
Sure.
Now, look here, Steve. I worked and slaved and scraped. I got almost enough money to go east. I'll be out of here another 2 weeks if you'll only...
Supposing that girl's family turns out to be dead rich. Suppose they take you for a tramp, won't even let you through the door. All because you wouldn't listen to me.
Well, I tell you,
Bret Hart's got a satchel full of money he's begging us to take. Trying to force it on us.
Steve, it's no use. I'm not going to catch you any frog.
Now, in a pond, a frog pokes his head above the surface. Sam stumbles around in the knee-deep water, and Steve motions from the bank.
Steve, come on over this way. Come on. Right over here, Sam.
Now, I'll get him if you just sit still a minute.
The frog sits on a soggy mound.
Hiya, Sam.
Sam swats his hat.
Did you miss him?
Yeah, I missed him.
Keep after him now, Sam.
Yeah.
He's a good frog.
I'll get
him. Down there, Sam?
No, I missed him.
Come on.
I'll get him.
Come on, a little further forward.
But I see him. I'll grab him by the legs.
A frog slips through his fingers.
That one didn't have any legs.
A wide-eyed frog pokes his head out of the water. Sam lunges and stumbles into some cattail reeds.
All I got was a mouthful of cattails.
Now, don't get to giving up. There's 100 good frogs in here. There's one. There's a real chance.
I'll get him.
He approaches another frog.
Right now, Steve.
His hat in hand, Sam readies himself. As Sam moves closer, Steve watches, grabbing air. Sam lunges.
No, Sam. Go more to your left. Go to the left, Sam.
You quit telling me what to do, Steve. Tell these frogs what to do.
Another frog pokes his head up from the water. Sam removes his hat and swats at it.
I never saw such slippery frog. They must have eel blood in them.
I give up, Steve. You come in and try it yourself.
Ain't no use. Can't stay here all day.
Sam puts his dripping hat back on.
Where's the frog?
I didn't catch it.
Sam's hat jiggles. He clutches it to his head.
Yes, I did.
Oh, we're sure set to collect now.
Here, you take this money and bet every cent of it on our frog. You just bet the whole town.
Wait a minute. Where on earth did this money come from?
Sam clamps his hat down.
Well, some of it I took from your mattress.
And the rest of it, I
give the landlady a note. Of course, I had to sign your name.
Steve,
for heaven's sake, I'll be 4 years paying this off.
Oh, Sam. Did I ever let you down?
Yes.
Oh, now, Sam, don't talk like an innie. I tell you, I know what I'm talking about. It's impossible for us to lose. I tell you, we are in.
Steve topples into the water.
Sam! Oh!
Sam lowers his hands. His hat jumps up and he grabs it tight. Now a marching band's drum reads, Angels Camp Miners Band. Townspeople wave at the passing parade. A man in fancy clothes rides in a buggy and bows to the crowd. A mustached man wearing a badge holds up a frog in a cage labeled Daniel. A tall man on horseback nods to the crowd. Sam and Steve ride together. They exchange a wary look. The finely dressed man rings a triangle.
Free drinks, everybody!
The crowd mills around a park. Some sit in tree branches. A hand sets down the cage marked Daniel, then another picks it up. Now Steve holds the frog and sets down the empty cage.
Thank you for making me chairman of the Jumping Jubilee.
Steve pours buckshot into his palm.
Oh, no! Why we're gathered here today?
As he crouches by a bush, Steve turns the frog head up, then pours the buckshot pellets down the frog's throat. He glances around with a sneaky grin.
Men of California!
The chairman addresses the crowd.
And Nevada! We're here today to decide a mighty serious thing, a mighty serious challenge. Daniel Webster, the longest jumping frog in the Golden West, owned by Bret Hart of Angels Camp.
Hart holds his frog proudly.
Stood undefeated against all comers.
Here's the honor.
And now comes an unknown frog from Virginia City.
Steve lifts his frog by the legs.
Named after one of our leading citizens, that fine laundryman and cook, One Long Hop.
Sam glances around nervously.
Owned by Steve Gillis and Sam Clemens. Gentlemen, the honor of our two great cities is in the balance. I ask for fair play, and we're here to see that everybody gets it.
Remember, each frog gets three jumps, a sum total counts. This year, visiting frog gets the first jump.
Bring on your frog, Steve Gillis!
Steve nods and leans towards Sam.
You get the money down?
Every cent.
Steve carries his boxed frog into the clearing as onlookers bet.
Here's a hundred. You allow jumping.
I'll embrace a man approaches yet. Two Chinese
men. You want about $50 on tender, Webster? Really sorry. Me were the hop.
The judge addresses Steve.
Round your frog!
The judge steps into the clearing.
Remember, one tickle on the first jump only.
Steve puts his frog on the disc. Hart watches smugly.
Why, gentlemen, it's virtually an insult to this magnificent specimen. I repeat, an insult to pit him against the puny entry of my belittler. 20-1.
An onlooker turns to his neighbor.
Gentlemen, we're taking all bets. 20-1.
Loose hold can leave a fire.
Tickle and bird, Steve.
Now hunch them muscles and heave.
The frog jumps.
Jump one.
Get consigne.
It takes another jump.
And two.
It's the third and last jump.
The frog sits motionless.
Come on now, one long hop. Hop.
The frog flexes its rear legs. Steve opens his mouth and fans his arms behind the frog.
Hop.
The frog sets off. A group of children gape. Their gaze follows the frog as it leaps high in the air. Hart smirks.
Doesn't mean a thing.
The judge uses a stick and measures.
3, 6, 9, 12.
A few inches remain. The judge measures on with his fingers. As the crowd watches, Steve blows dirt off the starter disc.
What's your measure?
The judge counts on his fingers.
12, 6, and 2/16.
Hart looks around smugly. Steve grins at Sam.
It ain't too previous to tell you, but we're going to be rich.
Sam's brow furrows.
That was a great jump, Steve. Now bring forth Daniel Webster.
Hart swaggers into the clearing with the caged frog.
Gentlemen, you're on the threshold of history.
He gently places the cage on the ground, kneels beside it, and pulls a handkerchief from his pocket. With a few swats, he dusts off the wooden disc. He picks up a pebble and throws it aside, then blows on the plate. He shoos back the crowd.
A little more room, gentlemen. That's it. Wouldn't like to have anybody injured. Further back, further back. Give this amphibian marvel some room.
Round your frog, sir!
Just try to line, Daniel.
The open cage sits in front of the disc. The frog stays inside. Hart eyes it a moment, then pokes his finger in the cage and nudges Daniel. Now he picks up the frog and places it on the disc.
Aim, frog, and jump it well!
Mind now, only one tickle on the first jump. That's all, neighbor.
Thank you, Judge. Daniel doesn't need it.
The judge scowls.
Get your knees into it now, Daniel. Get ready, Daniel. Fly.
Daniel strains as his round belly rubs the disc.
That's the first jump!
Sam glances at Steve. Hart leans over Daniel.
Pull yourself together, Daniel. Get your mind on this.
Give it everything. Flies.
Daniel jumps about an inch.
That's the second.
Steve stares blankly at the frog. Sam's brow furrows. Hart removes his Panama hat and fans the sluggish frog.
I asked you to get further back. He's afraid to let go.
Get back, folks. Get back.
The crowd gives Daniel a wide berth.
Now he can jump. Stranger, would you be so kind as to remove that face?
Hart points to the cross-eyed man.
Give it everything. Flies.
As the frog's bulbous eyes look round, Steve grins. Sam glances suspiciously.
You've never thrown off on me yet, Daniel. If you love me. If you love me, give me the beans. Flies.
The judge checks his watch.
If he ain't budged in 20 seconds, he's out.
Steve muffles a laugh.
Flies.
Daniel pushes up on all fours, straining to lift his weighted middle. The crowd of onlookers lean in to watch. The frog extends its hind legs, lifts its bulging body a few inches, then sits back down. The judge checks his pocket watch. Daniel hops a few inches.
That's the third jump. That's official.
Hart stares dejectedly at the crowd. Sam frowns. As dozens of gamblers move in around him, Hart mops his brow with his handkerchief and takes off his hat.
I'll pay off every legal bet. It's the usual weather. I demand a rejump under more auspicious conditions.
The mob ushers him off. A hand removes Daniel from his cage just as a booted foot steps up and crushes it. Now dozens of buckshot pellets cover the ground as Sam shakes the frog upside down.
Steve, I don't know how you got a full pound of buckshot into Daniel. But it was very wrong.
Yeah, we sure won, didn't we?
Sam looks at Daniel.
What's about? Ain't you happy?
Well, I didn't think so much of our frog, Steve. He looked kind of puny to me, so I bet everything we had on the chance on Daniel.
You mean that you... Hold on!
Steve drags Sam back through the crowd. They pass two men in a fist fight. The angry crowd of gamblers pressing close around the judge. Now, a hand writes with a quill pen, the jumping frog of Calaveras County. In compliance with the pen stops, and Sam crosses it out, crumples the paper, and tosses it. He puffs on his cigar and stares off in space. He muses a few seconds, then begins again. Later, Sam's bow tie hangs loose from his unbuttoned shirt collar. He puts down his pen and gathers scattered pages on his desk. He stacks the pages together, takes his pen, and writes on the cover page, by Samuel L. Clett. He looks up from the page, and another newsman enters.
You're going to keep on writing forever? Well, good night, Sam. See you in the morning.
Billings, you mind if I sign your name to this?
What for?
Well, I want to send it to New York, and it didn't much good.
You sign my name to a lot of silly drivel, and I'll sue you. I aim to do a little writing myself one of these days.
Billings heads out wearing a stovepipe hat and overcoat. Sam turns back to his desk, puts his pen to paper, then freezes. He thinks a moment, then crosses out his name. Underneath it, he writes, Mark Twain. He adds a flourish under the signature. Later, Sam licks the flap of a large envelope. He presses the wet flap and seals it, running his hand along the fold. He stands and starts to drop the envelope into a canvas bag marked U.S. Mail. He pauses with the envelope over the open bag, then he pulls his hand back and flings it into the wastebasket by his desk. Quickly, he puts on his hat, throws his coat over his arm, and stoops to extinguish the oil lamp. He stares into the glowing lamp, then reaches into the wastebasket, retrieves the envelope, and flings it into the mailbag. Daytime. In town, men on foot and horseback head down the main street. Steve enters a restaurant as Sam eats.
Quick! It's been discovered.
What, the body?
No, this. Look, it's worth $10,000 a ton. Oh, come on, Sam. You never get rich writing and reading. And this is the richest strike since the Comstock load. Now, look, everybody be there ahead of us. We got to hurry.
Sam dons his hat and overcoat, and they head outside.
Buck just rode in with a word. The whole town's on the move. We got to get horses.
You round up the horses. I'll get the rigging. Oh, this is the chance I've been waiting for.
Steve takes off in one direction as Sam heads in the other. On the busy street, men, horses, and wagon wheels all travel forward. Now, a man in city clothes walks against the flow of traffic. In his long coat and plaid trousers, he weaves through the crowd. He taps a bearded man on the shoulder.
Pardon me, I'm a stranger.
That's all right, mister. Who is?
The bearded miner continues on, and the stranger dodges the passing townspeople. He stops an elderly man with a white mustache.
Where can I find Mark Twain? Better see Sam Clemens. He knows everybody.
The stranger heads down the muddy street. Men leading pack mules laden with gear trudge past. Now, at a blacksmith's.
Come on. Hurry up with that extra shoe.
Hold your horses, fella. Hold your horses.
We gotta get you going, or everything will be took.
I beg your pardon. Do you know a man named Mark Twain?
I never heard of him. Try the jail.
A mule bumps him.
I beg your pardon.
The stranger hurries off through the crowd. As he stands in the street, wagons, pack mules, and men on horseback stream past him. Now the wooden sign reading Queen of Dixie Silver or Gold Mine is thrown on a pile of debris in the back of a wagon. Nearby, a man with a shovel adds a rock to the pile as the horse-drawn wagon heads off. An empty wagon pulls up behind it. Workers carrying tools bustle around the mine site. One man steers a wheelbarrow full of rock. Sam and Steve arrive on horseback. Sam glances around.
Hey, this looks kind of familiar.
Two miners crank winches on either end of a drum over a deep shaft. Sam and Steve find a man who's directing the workers.
That's the best I can do. I'm sorry, boys, but there's nothing left. We've gotten rid of everything. You're just too late.
Sam and Steve approach the mine foreman.
Check that load up at the top shaft.
Hey, mister, where can we stake our claim?
If you boys had only been here an hour ago, I could have sold you 50 or 60 feet of the vein at only $1,000 a foot.
You mean there ain't any left even at that?
No, I'm sorry. Oh, Tim, you'll need two teams on that.
You remember this place, Sam? How we located our mine because the mule wouldn't go no further? We owned the whole mountain. Do you realize where you're standing?
Of course I realize where I'm standing. Standing exactly in the marks where that other jackass stood.
Now, in the Enterprise.
But I've traced Mark Twain to this very office.
What's that again?
Now, look, please. If you'll think a moment, you must know a man named Mark Twain.
Now, back in town.
I kept on begging and begging you, but would you?
No. Stop it, will you, Steve? You want to drive me crazy?
Sam ties the horses.
So your mind's set, huh?
Out in this country, I'm nothing but a public risk.
Well, we're gonna miss you, Sam. You and your tall tales. Man won't know where to go for a real overpowering lie with you out of the way.
I'm through playing the fool, Steve. The only place in the world where I belong is at the wheel of a steamboat. And the quicker I get back to it, the better.
Sam strides into the Enterprise.
I'm sorry, Mr. Pond, but I never heard the name.
Well, now look here, Sam. Quick, grab some paper. Gotta get an extra in the street.
He hands Sam a pad.
Look here. I'd like to ask you this.
Fort Sumter's been fired on.
Fort Sumter?
By who?
The North and the South are at war.
Mississippi River is closed. Federal Army is marching on Virginia.
The Mississippi River is what?
Blockade. Steamboat sunk at St. Louis. Trying to run the shore batteries.
Sam frowns and sinks into a chair.
No steamboats? No river trade?
And maybe no country. Here, Billy, put this in column one.
Sam drops the paper and hurries toward the door.
Hey, where are you going?
I'm gonna push the Northern armies into the sea, if I can get transportation.
Wait a minute, what's your name?
Sam turns to Pond.
Sam Clemens, river pilot.
Oh.
Pond scratches his neck.
Well, there must be a Mark Twain somewhere.
Now, soldiers charge into cannon fire. Newspaper headlines read, Federals crushed at Bull Run. And Union troops routed at Fredericksburg. Now in a newspaper office, an editor hands copy to an assistant.
Joe,
Put this Mark Twain frog story on the front page with the war news.
On the front page, boss?
If the country ever needed one flicker of a smile, it needs it now.
A headline in the New Orleans Gazette reads, "Bitter fighting at Brandy Station." Then, in a montage, a frog leaps across our view and squats on a newspaper. Another headline reads, "The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County." Now, in a newspaper office.
And he held Daniel upside down. That frog belched up a double handful of birdshot.
Pond overhears the men.
One man has kept laughter alive. I can't find him.
Say, if you mean the fellow that wrote the Jumping Frog, his name's Sam Clemens. He used to be pilot of the Queen of Dixie. You'll likely find him somewhere along the river.
It's Billings in a Union uniform smoking a pipe. Now, a San Francisco Globe headline reads, "Richmond evacuated." Now, the Baltimore Star headline, "Deadlocked in wilderness." Then, headline after headline reads, "Peace," as General Grant rides past cheering onlookers. Now, a steamboat in ruins is moored off a levee. Its hull reads, "Queen of Dixie," on the riverbank. Sam gazes at the derelict boat. Pond approaches.
Pretty run down, isn't she?
Sam glances up.
Oh, I don't know. That's a good crop of oat hay on a boiler deck.
I'd give something to find the pilot of that steamboat.
I'd give something to find a steamboat.
Several years ago, I went all the way to California looking for the pilot of that boat. Could have made him a fortune, too, if I'd only known his name was not Mark Twain.
Sam gazes off slyly.
Isn't that a pretty slim clue? Must be dozens of people not named Mark Twain.
His name was Sam Clemens. Used to pilot this very boat. Say, aren't you...
Sam shoots him a look.
Yes, I remember. I met you in the office of the Enterprise. You were Sam Clemens. You wrote the Jumping Frog. Say, this is magnificent. I'll have you lecturing in New York within 2 weeks.
Oh, no, you don't.
I'll make you famous. I'll make you successful.
Not me. I tried making a speech once.
Think of the opportunity.
I'm not going to make you any speech.
A frog leaps into the muddy river water. Now, a poster reads, "The celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County on Monday evening, May 12th, 1867. Tickets 50 cents. Doors open at 7 o'clock. The wisdom will begin to flow at 8. Men and ladies in fancy dress stroll past the poster into a hall. Out front, a line of people wait to enter. Inside the hall, every seat is filled with well-dressed patrons. Now, backstage, Pond approaches Sam.
Something must have happened, that's a sure thing. We can't wait any longer, Sam. The senator must have missed his train.
Look here, Pond, somebody's got to introduce me. Not a soul in that audience knows me from Adam.
You don't need an introduction. These people came to hear the man who wrote The Jumping Frog.
Nobody remembers that. Hon, I'm sorry I let you hollow me into this. I'm just not cut out for it, that's all. I wish to heaven I never had any relations with that frog.
Now just a minute, you'll be all right.
Don't push me into this.
We'll fix it.
I tell you, I'd commit suicide this minute if I had the pluck and the outfit.
Pond nudges Sam onto the stage. Sam walks out to the center, fidgeting his watch chain nervously. He glances at Pond in the wings.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Sam's gaze circles the audience, then freezes on Langdon and his sister.
I know that man. His name's Sam Clemens.
Langdon's sister shyly looks down, then smiles. Sam takes a breath.
It is my distinguished pleasure to introduce your principal speaker tonight.
Pond's jaw drops.
Mark Twain is too well known to require a formal introduction at my hands. So I'm out here to do a useless thing. And that's right in my line.
Sam's hand fidgets on the podium. Langdon and his sister laugh.
Halley's Comet comes back to this Earth every 75 years, which is wonderful. Science cannot explain why it wants to come back after a good look at us. Mark Twain rode into this world on the tail of that comet. And after tonight, a great many people are going to be disappointed if it don't come right back and take him away again.
Sam shifts on his feet.
I give you Mark Twain.
Sam holds out his hand to the wings. Pond shrugs. Pond winces as Sam nears the wings.
I give you Mark Twain.
Sam stares at Pond, then heads off stage. As the audience glances around, Mark Twain walks back on stage and stands next to the podium.
I thank the previous speaker.
I have seldom in my lifetime listened to compliments so felicitously phrased or so well deserved.
Langdon's sister laughs. Her brother and the rest of the audience join in.
When I think of what the newspapers are going to do to me tomorrow, I wish I could count on as good an epitaph as we gave an old colored woman I used to know who fell on a hot stove and was roasted.
In the wings, Pond wipes his brow.
After a great deal of thought, we just put on her tombstone, "Well done, good and faithful servant."
In the front row, ladies with fancy hoop skirts laugh.
One of my recent southernmost trips...
He points downward.
I overheard Satan himself complaining to a newcomer. He said, trouble with you New York people is that you think you're the best people down here, whereas you are merely the most numerous.
A portly man laughs, holding his stomach. Beside him, a lady in a black evening dress throws the man a disapproving look. Now, hands on a clock sweep quickly from 8:30 to 9:30. Faces appear over the swiftly moving clock. First, the portly man, then Langdon's sister. Now on stage, Mark checks his pocket watch.
I thought I'd only be able to speak about 5 minutes, and I've talked an hour and a half. I wonder if you'd let me say one serious thing that I feel very much.
As the audience applauds, Langdon beams. His sister smiles at Mark. She wears a white dress and a lacy veil. On stage, Mark sets his glass of water down and leans on the podium.
I just want to say, men will always vary in nature, race, creed, and desires. They'll always be the belligerent and the oppressed. But in our country, we can and must hold fast to our ideal of democracy because we've made it a shining reality. Let's cherish our proud traditions of freedom and tolerance. Let's vow that our tolerance will never become indifference and our freedom never become license. Let's respect each other's rights and defend with the pen if possible or the sword if need be our inalienable privilege to be a free and united people.
As several in the audience rise to their feet, Mark's gaze settles on Langdon's sister. The young woman sits quietly in her seat, her eyes glistening with tears. Later, backstage, Pond chats with well-wishers.
This is indeed a very great pleasure. Pardon me, Mr. Howells, if you will wait here a moment, I'll get Mr. Twain. He's very anxious to meet you.
Pond approaches Mark.
Will you excuse me, please? William Dean Howells is here. I just got hold of him.
Who?
Of the Atlantic Monthly, the foremost literary critic in the country, and he looks perfectly bland. Now, look, please play up to him. He's terribly important. Mr. Howells.
Were all those stories true, Mr. Twain?
I wanted to tell you, my aunt had a most amusing experience with the mule.
Mark's eyes search the room.
Mark, I'm very happy to...
Just a moment.
Mark heads to Langdon.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How'd you enjoy the lecture?
He certainly has a fine sense of humor. You know, I met him when he was piloting on the Mississippi.
Mark smiles at Langdon's sister.
Excuse me.
I'm so glad to see you. Libby, I'd like to present Mr. Clemens or Mr. Twain. My sister,
I knew you in a second, Mr. Clemens.
Mark stares at Livy.
I'm afraid I've been talking to your sister all evening. Did you notice?
Why, I...
We hope you'll make an appearance in Elmira.
Well, thank you. That's mighty kind.
Well, we'll have to hurry to catch our train.
What are we waiting for? Come on.
Mark takes Langdon and Livy by the arm and they all hurry off. Pond does a double take. Now at the Langdons.
Yes, I know, but how does he become a house guest?
Well, honestly, Father, I don't quite know.
All this is rather preposterous, you know.
Yes, sir, I'm afraid it's more so than you realize, sir. You see, when I met Mr. Twain on the river, Livy's picture caught his eye and he promptly announced that he was going to marry her.
Marry her? He's got to get out of here. The presumption of these Westerners is beyond endurance.
Mark sits with Livy and her mother.
So just as he grabs for the cat, Miss Langdon, he slips on the icy rope.
Mrs. Langdon glares at Mark.
And he goes avalanching down through the trellis, right in the middle of my sister's party, in his nightshirt.
Really?
Mark takes out a cigar, bites off the end, then turns to spit out the tip. He eyes Mrs. Langdon and stops.
I tell you,
If you ever knew Jim Wolfe.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Twain, but you barely have time to make the 9:25.
Why, Jervis.
I'm sorry.
Mark sets his tea down and picks up his dessert.
Oh, I got no real call to...
I'll be happy to drive you to the depot.
Don't put yourself to the trouble.
Don't mention it.
The carriage is ready, Father.
Thank you. Mr. Twain, we'll just be able to make it.
Young Langdon picks up Mark's bag and follows his father to the door. Mark puts down his fork and rises to leave. Libby watches sadly.
Well, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Mr. Twain.
He shuffles a couple of steps towards the door, stops, and turns to Libby.
I just want you to know whatever happens next, I wouldn't have missed this. Not for all the steamboats that ever rode the Mississippi.
She smiles demurely. Mrs. Langdon places a consoling hand on her daughter's arm. Outside, a carriage waits.
Goodbye, Mr. Clemens. I hope we'll see you again soon.
Step right in, Mr. Twain. You must hurry.
The driver's seat is propped forward while Sam climbs into the back. The footman pulls the seat upright, and Mr. Langdon climbs in. Sam reaches down and removes a metal pin. As Langdon snaps the reins, the seat collapses and Sam falls out.
Now, how did he manage to do that?
Sam grimaces.
Mr. Clemens, did you hurt yourself? What a stupid thing to have happen.
Careful, Charles, careful.
Let's take him inside.
Quick, get the doctor.
They carry Sam inside. Now, surrounded by the Langdon family, Sam lies in bed with a bandage on his head. The doctor puts a thermometer into Sam's mouth and listens with his stethoscope. Livy gazes wistfully at Sam.
What part of the anatomy did you say he fell on?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Sam turns his eyes towards Livy. She glances around the room of people. Sam takes a labored breath, the thermometer still sticking from his mouth. The doctor shakes his head.
Well, just to be safe, we'd better not move him for the present.
Langley rolls his eyes. Now, outdoors, a squirrel eats a nut.
He's certainly tame, isn't he?
Of course he is, Libby. You know as well as I do, there are no wild animals until man makes them so. I sometimes wonder who's better off.
You do have a very weak opinion of yourself, don't you?
Yeah, I guess so. I just don't belong in your world.
Then there's something wrong with my world.
No, there isn't, Libby. It's a wonderful world because it's got you in it.
Lightning flashes across the sky.
I'm an outsider. Tramp pilot. Mudcat with the river dried up.
Now, rain pelts Sam and Livy. Elsewhere, the squirrel scurries up a tree and darts into a hole in the trunk. Sam and Livy hurry down a path and dart into a gazebo. Livy smooths her hair.
Oh, there's an example of our temperamental New England weather.
That's the trouble with you folks here in the East. Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it.
As they shake off rain, Livy's gaze falls on Sam's crutch lying on the walk.
Guess you knew all the time I've been here.
Yes, I did.
Now that you found me out, you gonna tell on me?
Livy smiles and looks away.
I always knew that sometime I'd have to come and find you, see if you were real.
He sits on a bench.
But now...
Now you're disappointed.
Now that I know you, you're so much finer, so much dearer than anything I could ever dream. I know you can't ever marry me. I know now that isn't possible. But anyway, I'll always be sure the best thing I ever did was to fall in love.
He gazes sadly at Livy.
Well, I reckon I got to give back something I got that doesn't rightfully belong to me.
He takes her portrait from a breast pocket and gives it to her.
Why, where on earth did you get this?
The first time I saw it, I knew I'd never seen anyone so beautiful, so sweet, and so I stole it. It's been in the bottom of mines, up mountains, across plains, everywhere with me. For a long time.
He drops his eyes.
My mom.
She turns pensively away.
Pretty silly of me, I see now.
He goes to her.
I couldn't even support you. Your father's made that clear to me in 100 different ways. And he's right.
She faces him.
Mark, why did you come east?
To look for you.
That's what brought Sam Clemens here. But Mark, answer me this. Why did Mark Twain come east?
He sits on a bench next to her.
You've forgotten about him, haven't you?
Yeah, I guess I have.
I'm not going to let you forget him again. Because I'm going to be with you.
His eyes widen.
I don't care whether we ever have anything or not. I just want to be with you.
You can say that in spite of your family and everybody and everything.
I knew it the night of the lecture. The first time I looked at you.
Libby, I'd split the world wide open for you to prove you're right.
She hands back the portrait.
So this is yours now. And you can stop all this lying and stealing.
Libby, I give you my word. I'll never tell another lie. He must have hurt me.
Now, in a study, Mr. Langdon pores over papers.
Come in.
Mark enters and somberly approaches Langdon at his desk. The elderly gentleman looks up at Mark.
Sit down, Mr. Twain.
Mark takes a seat.
Or Mr. Clemens.
Rhymes with lemons.
Oh, I see. I finally heard from your friends whom you yourself requested to write to me.
I guess I felt I needed a few words in my favor.
This clergyman, the Reverend Stephen Gillis of Jackass Hill, says that he expects you to fill a drunkard's grave.
Well, would you look at that? I suppose I've lied for that man 500 times. Wouldn't you think he could do as much for me just this once?
Langdon rises.
Clemens, what kind of people are these? Haven't you a single real friend in the world?
Surely don't seem so, does it?
I admire you for one thing, Mr. Clemens. Your cool courage makes Washington at Valley Forge look timid.
Mark shrugs.
Well,
I'm told that you're a writer.
Perhaps.
Perhaps we here have a little different conception as to what a writer is. Emerson, Longfellow, Whittier, Oliver Wendell Holmes, men born of these rocks and hills, great shadowy names like gods on Olympus. We think of these as writers.
Mark squirms in his seat.
I should not have thought that some comic bits tossed off in catchpenny papers would have entitled anyone to class himself among them.
Well, Mr. Langdon, I don't claim to be...
I have talked to Livy. I have no further hope of changing her purpose.
Mark looks off.
You think it's as bad as...
Livy is a delicate, sensitive girl. You've elected to take her away from everything she's lived for.
Mr. Langdon, I swear to you, I'd give my
Mother,
life...
Livy Mother, rushes in.
Mother just gave me this. Mark, look at it.
She hands him a paper.
What is it? Some kind of summons?
No, no, it's the deed to a house in Buffalo. Father's wedding gift to us. Oh, why did you have to scare me so when all the time you meant to do this wonderful thing?
Livy, your happiness means everything to me.
Well, Mr. Langdon, sir, I just want you to know if you're ever up in our vicinity, you can come and stay with us. Stay overnight if you want to, and it won't cost you a cent.
Mark offers his hand. Langdon eyes him sternly, then shakes it. Now, book spines in a shop window read, Roughing It and Innocence Abroad. Next to a sign, works of the popular new humorist Mark Twain. Lettering on the window reads, Buffalo Toy Shop. Two children, dressed in winter clothes, stare at a window display where miniature soldiers circle a grinning clown. Mark, dressed in coat and shoulder cape, enters and greets the shopkeeper as snow falls outside.
Good evening.
Mr. Twain.
Good evening.
It's good to see you again. I don't know how I'd stay in business without you. You got a contract for some orphanage, Sam?
Mark picks up a toy lamb.
I like to play with these myself.
It's for a little boy, a tiny little boy. I know. I can tell by the thing you always pick. How old is he?
Well, in some ways, by actual count, he's only about a year, but...
But him and you are just the same age. Isn't that right?
I can run a month on a compliment like that.
I know. I know. You couldn't write like you do. If you was any different.
The shopkeeper picks up a book.
Well, Mr. Twain. Mr. Twain, could you do me the honor to write your name in Innocence Abroad? I've read it four times.
Mark signs it.
Good. Good.
No, it's you that's good to ask me.
Would you write your name in Roughing It, too? I read this one seven times.
By George, I'm going to refund you my royalty.
He signs the book, Mark Twain.
Will you bring your little boy in to see me? I'd like to meet him.
The very minute he gets over his cold.
Good, good. Oh, how about this nice Noah's Ark?
No. I'm opposed to Noah. This world would be a lot better off if Noah had missed the boat.
He picks up a toy steamboat.
Yeah, this is more like it. Just what I wanted. I'm sure he'll like this.
Now, Libby holds the steamboat in a dimly lit bedroom. She gazes sadly down at a crib, her brow furrowed. Next to her, Mark stares at the crib. Libby turns to Mark, showing tear-stained cheeks.
He doesn't see it.
Clenching his jaw, Mark stares at the boy.
He doesn't see it.
Libby breaks into tears. Mark's eyes fix on the child in the crib. Libby's jaw drops as a tiny hand stretching out of the crib goes limp.
Get Dr. Quentin, quick!
Mark rushes out of the room and Libby drops her head. A shaggy dog sits on its hind legs and puts its front paws on the crib. Now, Libby carries a tray down a staircase as Mark sits at his desk. She enters Mark's study and sets the food and drink in front of him. He looks up blankly, resting his head on one hand while the other holds a quill and a sheet of paper. She meets his gaze, then looks away. She turns up a lamp and the bright light shines on her face.
Have some tea.
Mark listlessly scoots the quill and paper away from him. Libby smiles weakly.
Is it going any better, Mark?
I can't write it, Libby. I don't reckon I'll ever write anything again.
Her smile fades as Mark stares off.
I wanted to take our little boy to the Mississippi. I wanted to take his hand and wade with him in the Mississippi mud.
He pulls back his chair and rises to his feet.
I can feel that mud between my own toes yet. I can hear the steamboat whistles far off down the bend.
Lamplight falls on Livy's face.
He'll never see the river now.
Livy turns to Mark, then reaches out and gently touches his arm.
No, Mark. Our little son will never see it. But, Mark, you must save those things you love. You must save them for whole generations of little boys, of all ages, forever. You mustn't let those precious things be lost.
Livy stares fervently at Mark.
You're the only man who ever lived who can do it, Mark. Because you're the only man in the world who still is that little barefoot boy.
They walk to the desk.
Wading in the Mississippi mud, playing on the raft, watching the steamboats, the way you've told me so many times.
It all seems so long ago.
But you remember. You remember it all as nobody else ever can. You do remember.
She presses her lips to his forehead.
You've got to remember.
Mark touches Livy's cheek, then pulls her close and kisses her. Libby finishes their kiss, and Mark takes his pen and dips the quill in the inkwell. As Mark begins to write, Libby leaves the study and goes to the staircase. The dog joins her at the door and follows her upstairs. On the paper, Mark writes a title, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Images appear from Mark's memory. Four boys scramble on a sinking raft. Then, the Queen of Dixie travels the Mississippi. Now, Mark writes Chapter 9 as the toy steamboat sits beside him. Wearing a smoking jacket, he puffs on a pipe. Now, in shirt sleeves, he descends the front steps of a cottage, then writes outside sitting on a bench. A wooden cup with 8 cigars sits next to him. Later, only one cigar remains. Now, Mark's handwritten words fill a page. Then, Mark writes and smokes a corncob pipe in bed. Later, at a desk, a pen slips from his fingers as he nods off. As his head bobs sleepily, a 6-inch-high boy in tattered clothes jumps onto his desk. He carries a fishing pole. He sees the sleeping Mark, then looks over his shoulder.
Come on, Huck. Hurry, Jim.
Now, a tiny Huck, Jim, and their dog join Tom. Jim points to Mark's words.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, what'd that say?
What does pirates have to do? Tom said, hey, that's me.
They face Mark.
Hey, what'd I say?
As Mark groggily opens his eyes, the three boys and the dog run away. Mark takes his pen.
I wasn't asleep. Just rest in my eyes.
He starts to write. Later, he scrawls the word Fini at the bottom of a page. Now, kittens play on a sofa as Libby reads a manuscript. Sam approaches, holding another kitten.
Are you nearly finished?
Shh,
He paces, stroking the cat. Libby looks up and smiles.
Oh, Mark. Mark, it's so great. So human, so real.
You think anybody will ever read it?
Read it? Why, the whole world's going to read it. In every language, in every country. This year and next year and in 1,000 years, they'll still be reading it. Do you know what you've done? You've captured youth. You've given eternal youth to every living mortal who can read.
Libby, if you like it, that's all I care about.
Youth. That's what you are.
She rests her head on his shoulder.
I'll never be able to think of you as anything else.
In an office, the magazine editor, Howells, reads The Gilded Age. An assistant approaches.
Mr. Howells. Mr. Howells. Would you sign these, please?
Why, yes, of course.
That's Mark Twain's latest work, isn't it, sir?
I think this book should cure every torpid liver and chronic grouch in America.
Married it later, sir. I read everything he's written.
You have?
Well, nearly everyone I know has read Roughing It, sir. And Tom Sawyer. That was a great one.
All Mark Twain's books have been great, Hardy. I'll tell you how I know. I tried to read a book solely from the standpoint of a critic, but in spite of everything, I find myself reading Mark Twain's books from the standpoint of a human being.
The public must agree with you, sir. Our subscriptions jump enormously every time Mark Twain's name appears on the cover.
That reminds me, I want to send him an invitation. Is he at Quarry Farm or at Hartford?
Hartford, sir.
Good. Take a letter. My dear Mark Twain.
Now, at a country mansion, Mark searches under a dresser. He stands and buttons his shirt.
Beats me. Beats me. How can they want me to speak? At Whittier's birthday, of all places.
Nearby, Livy sews.
And William Dean Howells, of all people, to ask you. Remember the night you swept by him after your first lecture?
Do I remember?
What are you looking for, dear?
Collar button.
It's in your shirt.
Oh, yeah. They're having people with names that we used to start mules with in Missouri. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry Waldo Longfellow, John Greenleaf Whittier, Oliver Waldo Holmes. Do you think I'd better speak as Mark Waldo Twain?
He fetches a bamboo fishing pole from the closet. Livy glances over.
Don't tell me you're going to wear that.
I'm afraid I threw my necktie out the window.
Oh, Mark, when will you stop doing those things? I'll find you another one.
He dangles the pole out the window.
Do you suppose they've actually read my things?
Oh, they couldn't.
She rummages through drawers.
It's just like unloading an ordinary mudcat on a passel of gods.
No, it isn't that at all. It's just that everything we've worked and waited and hoped for is suddenly all coming true. I can't wait to write to Father.
Hook the tie, all right. Now she's fouled.
The pole hooks the back of a man's cape at the front door. A butler opens the door and finds Howells. His cape raises behind him. The butler points.
I'm William Dean Howells.
The butler gapes.
Well, come on in if you feel all right.
The cape drops from the hook. Howells eyes a fidgety butler.
Rest yourself, sir.
Now upstairs.
I suppose I'm the happiest person in the world tonight. For you to be recognized and appreciated by people who know what's fine.
Livy, if one literary gentleman hollers snag, I'll probably jump overboard. Come in.
It's the jittery butler.
Excuse me. That was Mr. Howells. He's standing quiet. Now, he's down by the umbrella stand.
I better go down. Do give them your best tonight, Mark.
Mark kisses Livy.
I'll bust a boiler for him, Livy. Don't forget, I'm staying in town overnight.
I know, dear.
Said Mr. Howells wants you to fetch it in a hurry.
I'll be there.
I don't know which one these shoes are. Where are you going to put on all these shoes?
The butler carries off an armload of shoes. Now, Mark grimaces as he struggles with a bow tie. He throws down the tie and rips off the collar. Now he takes off the shirt and flings it out the window. Outside, it lands on Pond. The elegantly dressed Pond, now sporting a mustache, wads up the shirt and throws it back through the window. It lands on Mark's head. Mark leans out the window.
Oh, hello, Pond. Hey, Pond, have you got a pair of suspenders?
Suspenders, sure.
Well, let me have them, will you? Come on up the trellis.
Pond shakes his head, then starts to climb the vine-covered trellis. Halfway up, his hat falls off. Upstairs, Mark extends a hand to Pond.
Here, let me give you a hand.
Mark helps him inside.
George, there hasn't been such a battle between me and my equipment since the Grand Turk blew up midstream.
Is Howells here yet?
Yes, he's downstairs.
Well, you know, Mark,
This is the most important event since I met you on the levee.
Pond unhooks his suspenders and hands them to Mark.
Yeah. I'll promise you one thing, Pond. I'm going to hoist those big wigs with the doggonest surprise they ever had in their lives. It just came to me while I was dismissing that shirt. Yes, sir. I hope those fellows have a sense of humor.
Pond gapes. Huh? Now, men sit around candlelit tables.
And so I give you Mark Twain.
In an elegant banquet room, men in fancy dress sit at long tables under a crystal chandelier. Mark rises to his feet, and the men all face him.
Mr. Toastmaster?
Mark gives a short nod.
Mr. Whittier? Gentlemen.
His gaze takes in the room.
Standing here on the shore of the Atlantic and contemplating certain of its literary billows, I'm reminded of a thing that happened to me once when I had just succeeded in stirring up a little Western literary puddle myself.
Howells turns to a white-haired man beside him.
I'm sure you're going to enjoy Mark Twain, Mr. Whittier.
Yes. I started an inspection tramp through the mines of California. I was callow and conceited and resolved to try the virtue of my pen name. I very soon had an opportunity. I knocked at a miner's lonely cabin in the Sierra snows. A melancholy, barefooted man opened the door. And when I told him I was Mark Twain, he looked more dejected than before.
The men smile and sip wine.
He let me in pretty reluctantly, I thought. Then he said, in the voice of one who is secretly suffering, "You're the fourth literary man that's been here in 48 hours. I'm going to move." You don't tell me, said I. Who are the others? He said, Mr. Longfellow, Mr. Emerson, Mr. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Consound, such a rough bunch.
The elderly men give polite grins.
You can easily believe I was interested. I supplicated. Three hot whiskeys did the rest. Finally, the melancholy miner began. Said he, Mr. Holmes was as fat as a balloon. He weighed as much as 300.
Holmes arches his eyebrows.
Mr. Emerson was a seedy little bit of a chap, red-headed.
Emerson glowers.
Mr. Longfellow was built like a prize fighter. His head was cropped and bristly like a wig made of hairbrushes. And they'd been drinking, I could see that.
Howells shifts his eyes nervously.
However, I start to get out my bacon and beans. Mr. Holmes gets his eye on the jug. Says he, flash out a stream of blood-red wine, for I would drink 2 other days. Well, by George, I was getting kind of worked up.
Did you sponsor this? Never occurred to me.
So now Mr. Emerson, he points to me and he says, is yonder squalid peasant all that this proud nursery could breed? He is a whetting of his boy knife on his boot at the time, so I let that pass.
Mark takes in the men's stony gazes.
I stopped the miner. Said, why, these were not the gracious singers to whom the world pays loving reverence. These were impostors. A miner investigated me for a while and then said, impostors, were they? Are you? I did not pursue the subject.
Now, Langdon's face appears.
Emerson, Longfellow, Whittier, Oliver Wendell Holmes. We think of these as writers. And you compare yourself to these men?
Twain gulps and dabs his lips.
Mr. Chairman, in my enthusiasm, I may have exaggerated the details a little, but I hope you'll forgive me, since I believe this is the first time I have ever deflected from perpendicular fact on an occasion like this.
Mark's gaze shifts nervously. Now, the Hartford Daily's headline reads, Mark Twain dishonors tribute to Whittier, and comic writer's boorish derision. Another headline, Mark Twain shocks guests at Whittier banquet, bad taste in trade. Now, the Daily Intelligence, river pilot humorist fails at banquet, and in the Press Advocate, author of Jumping Frog commits literary suicide. Now, in a drawing room, Livy sorts through papers. As Mark enters, she hides them.
Lily, please. Please.
Mark approaches his sobbing wife.
I ought to be shot. Guess almost anybody'd be glad to furnish the powder and lead. I don't see how any one man can be so many kinds of a fool.
Mark.
She turns and places her hands on his. He leans close and gives her a tender kiss.
Lily, what on earth ever persuaded you to marry such an insufferable idiot?
Mark, I'm only crying because...
She picks up a stack of papers.
Because I've been reading your new story. Your Huckleberry Finn. It's the greatest thing you've ever done. It's greater than Tom Sawyer.
Don't you know? Haven't you heard?
You must tell me what's coming next in this wonderful story. And tell me by writing it, so it won't be lost. Finishing this is more important than anything else could be in the world. Believe me. Believe me, Mark. This is what matters.
They kiss. Now, with Pond, Mark holds his manuscript.
Hardly seems possible I could ever... If this is half as good as Livy seems to think...
Mark shuffles the pages and the clippings fall out.
I'm sorry, Mark. I hurried over to borrow the papers, but Livy must have cut out the reports hoping you wouldn't see them.
Mark looks at the various headlines. Pond touches his arm.
Don't let it beat you, Mark. That girl believed in me when not one voice, not one word was raised in my behalf. I promised my immortal soul that I'd prove she was right. I didn't know then that I'd have to change myself clear down to the roots. The way I think, the way I breathe, the very words I know. But I can do that too. I'll start again. I'll change the name I write with. Mark Twain. The Mississippi River did this to Livy. The mud of the Mississippi is in my blood. Upon, I'm going to get it out. I'm going to get it out if it's the last thing I do.
Now, on a wide country road, Mark and Livy ride in a horse-drawn carriage.
Mark, why won't you tell me where we're going?
Because I want to astound you. You'll see in a few minutes.
But can't you even say?
All I can say is you're going to see something that's going to revolutionize the civilized world.
Oh, is that all?
It's going to change our lives, too.
Change our lives?
I have plans, Livy. Plans for getting myself out of the mud. It's a plunge, I know that. Before we're through, we may have to pitch in every cent we've got. But what an opportunity. Maybe this is the best thing that's happened to me since the day Joe Twitchell married us.
Now, wooden beak-like tongs on hinged necks hover over boxes of printer's type.
Nothing like it's ever been seen in the world before. When I was a boy, I never dreamed it was possible.
What is it?
It's a typesetter. It sets type all by itself when you press these keys.
I know it looks ridiculous now, Livy, but the principle is amazing. It picks up the type here, and it sets it all together in the proper place here. Think of it, Livy. A machine setting hundreds of words a minute. Thousands of pages a day.
Hey, that's right, Mrs. Clemens. Of course, this machine is just to give you a crude idea. Just the principle of the thing. I'll show you. First, you wind the helical spring. Then... you release these.
The bald man pushes levers.
Bend the line shaft. Engage the clutch. Then you sit down and play like an organ.
He sits at the contraption's controls, which look like an organ's keyboard, and pushes lettered keys. The bird-like tongs pluck pieces of type and place them in trays where the type is stacked in rows.
See?
Livy frowns.
What'd I tell you?
The contraption jams, and the inventor presses the keys harder.
It needs a little adjustment.
He grabs a hammer and bends down near the base of the moving tongs. As he inspects the mechanism, one of the beak-like tongs pinches his hand.
Ouch! It's uncanny.
Can you see it, Livy?
Mark, is this what we're putting all our money into?
Oh, I don't mean this thing the way it is now. I'm seeing a great, smooth-running engine the way it's going to be someday. It'll reduce the cost of printing 50%. We can only get it perfected in time to start our publishing house with this.
What publishing house?
Livy, Huck Finn is the last funny book I'm ever going to write, I hope. Its royalties will have to last us a long time. So I'm going to publish it myself.
Mark, have you gone out of your mind?
I got 50 ideas for making publishing into a real thing, a whole new kind of publishing.
But no writer has ever before done...
That's it. Nobody, but we'll do it now. We sell 100,000 copies, 1,000,000 copies, cover the whole country, own our own paper mill. And then my hands will be free to write something serious and good.
But, Mark, everybody reads your stories and loves them.
But it isn't good enough, Livy. There are people in this world whose proper company is among the stars of the heavens. You're one of them. I mean to get the stars for you, Livy.
Now the inventor runs the machine.
You know, a little change here, a little change there, 5,000 more will perfect it.
Fine, fine, I'll give you a check. I tell you, we'll astound the world with that typesetter. Yes, sir, this is certainly the age of progress. Why, it beats me how anybody can keep from getting rich in this country. Telegraph lines race out and tie the hemisphere together. Railroads unroll across thousands of miles. The whole nation is coming of age. Great new leaders rise up. A Missouri tanner who fought the Battle of the Wilderness leads his country in new victories of peace.
The typesetter has developed too, Mark. 10,000 more will perfect it.
Our publishing house is growing, Mark. Its grosses run into tens of thousands.
Yeah, but why don't we make some profits?
Another funny book, Mark. You must have money.
Another and then another.
One more funny book for the publishing house.
One more for the typesetter.
Whole cities spring up. Great industries are born.
As Mark writes, books appear. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Life on the Mississippi, Sketches Old and New, A Tramp Abroad.
Needs money, Mark. Another book. Another. Perfect it.
$5,000.
$10,000.
Money, money, money. Money, money, money. Isn't there any end to this? Can't I ever free my hands for 1 year, 1 week, to do the single fine serious work I owe to Livy?
One more funny book. One more. For the typesetter. For the publishing house.
More, Mark, more. For the typesetter.
He emerges from a pool.
10,000 more, Mr. Twain.
Can't I even get 5 minutes to swim? While I scribble and scribble year after year, I tell you, the world is getting away from.
Would you stop now after 10 years of struggle and lose all you've invested?
Yes.
Now Mark talks to an accountant.
I've gotten into the worst mess ever seen. Well, you're the biggest financier in New York, Rogers. All you got to do is just get me out.
Well, when you asked me to straighten out your affairs, Mark, I had no idea they were so involved.
I want to get shut of everything. Typesetter, the publishing house.
I'm glad to hear you say that, Mark. I believe I can get you out of this now and still avoid bankruptcy.
Good, good. And just as soon as I publish this last book, we'll close the whole shebang.
Mark, if you invest one more cent in anything, I can't get you out.
This is the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. This is living history.
I'm sorry, Mark, but if you're going to get yourself out with a whole skin, you've got to stop now. You can't publish this or any other book. This...
Mark frowns at Rogers, then shifts his gaze.
Oh, all right.
He puts the manuscript away.
I'll see Grant and explain. I guess he'll understand.
Now, on a rainy day, Mark steps out of a carriage and climbs the steps of an urban building. He presses a doorbell, and a matronly black woman answers the door.
Oh, Mr. Twain.
Is the general in?
Yes, sir. He's in the study.
Mark folds his umbrella and steps in. The white-haired Grant sits with a blanket across his legs. He waves his hand weakly.
Mr. Twain, come in, come in.
Mark enters and shakes Grant's hand.
This is an honor.
General.
I regret that illness prevents me from rising. Pull up a chair. Sit down, my friend.
Thank you.
I regret also that circumstances prevent me from greeting you with more pomp and ceremony. Sit down.
General, I had no idea.
You have, Mr. Twain, but then times are moving and humanity is busy with its own affairs. I believe you once said to yourself that poverty is no disgrace, but it's a damnable inconvenience.
Mark looks around the modest room.
I presume you've come to talk about my book.
Oh, yes.
He opens the satchel.
Yes, I have come about the book.
I was delighted to have received your letters and to know that you thought so highly of my work.
General, you've had offers from other publishers.
Oh, yes, yes. You can't see them.
Mark slips on glasses and takes a handful of letters from Grant. He starts to read one document and frowns.
This is ridiculous.
He turns the document over.
This is outrageous. At every point, they've sensed the fair thing to do and scrupulously avoided. Only 10% royalty. General, if you ever permit yourself to sign such a contract as this...
Isn't that all I have a right to expect?
Right to expect?
Twain removes his glasses.
General Grant, Who has a right to expect more than you? In his own times, perhaps, General, no man is truly great. But believe me, sir, millions of children yet unborn will know and realize your greatness.
Grant furrows his brow.
Mr. Twain.
He stares into Twain's eyes.
That's the sincerest tribute that has ever been paid to any man.
Mark folds Grant's document. Now, Mark paces as Rogers glares.
Mark, you're insane. I warn you, this will bring about your absolute ruin.
I saw Grant ride into Washington at the head of 50,000 men, lean, strong, victorious. He rode straight into the White House then, and I saw him yesterday. It was unbelievable. He sat there broken, sick, oh, literally dying, but still courageous.
Well, we'll put on a campaign.
That's exactly what we can't do.
But, Mark, there are other publishers.
Yeah, I've seen their offers. They're taking a miserable advantage of his poverty and humiliation.
Was that cash advance and 70% of the gross? Have you committed yourself to these terms?
I tell you, there are things here bigger than you or me, Rogers. Or General Grant, even. When we turn our back on men like that, we're changing ourselves into something cowardly and weak and mean. Takes all the dignity out of humanity. Leaves us nothing but shame for what we are.
But all that isn't on your shoulders, Mark.
You know that I could publish this manuscript of his, and overnight his sad, broken beggary would end.
Do you honestly believe that Grant's book would prove such a tremendous success that it could pull you out of the hole?
I'm not interested in making one penny on the rescue of General Grant.
And that settles it. I tell you again, Mark, if you do this one thing more, I can never get you out. You'll be writing for the rest of your life just to pay off your debts. With bankruptcy staring you in the face.
Might be worth it.
He heads out.
Mark, General Grant would be the last one in the world to permit the slightest risk to anyone but himself. I beg of you, please consider it carefully and calmly.
With a curt nod, Sam leaves. Later, he thumbs through the manuscript at his desk. He rubs his mustache pensively and picks up his corncob pipe. Then he searches through a pencil cup on his desk.
Katie! Katie, Larry!
He rummages around.
Where in blazes are my pipe cleaners now? What kind of ornery dunderheaded...
A plump maid enters.
...with around here? Katie, Larry, a wild Larry Trenian. What do you mean by this? How many thousand times have I...
How after eating it, you know that you should be hollering the top off tonight?
Let me tell you something, Katie, Larry. There's nothing lower on this earth than a pipe cleaner stealer.
Oh, boosh, and be shame to you with the little ones so close to in bed. Yeah. So upset they will be with your bawling and bellerin that they'll fair fail to get a week's sleep.
That pipe cleaner was worth upwards of $5,000. If you'd stop your infernal raids on my desk, quit making an everlasting wreck of this dump, things wouldn't be so dismal calamitous around here. Now watch this.
He chalks a line on the carpet.
You see that line? If you ever dare set foot across that line again, you'll instantly die 7 different deaths. All of them new.
Katie's gaze freezes on Mark's breast pocket. She reaches over.
There's your pipe cleaner. Foul plague that it be.
Who put it there?
The idea of a grown man behaving like you do. He's worse than a lot of children.
As Katie heads out, Livy enters.
Mark, I know it's a terribly hard decision to make, but you shouldn't take it out on Katie.
I'm not angry at Katie. She's just excitable.
I wish I could help you. But whatever you decide to do about General Grant, I know we'll be right.
I'm not at all sure I want to be right. When I think of the number of disagreeable people I know who've gone to a better world, I'm moved to lead the worst life I can.
3 little girls come in.
Come on, Papa. Papa, we're waiting for you to tell us a story.
Jean, Susie.
I'm coming.
I'll put them to bed.
I can still do that, can't I?
He takes towels from Livy.
If it were anyone in the world but General Grant...
Come on, darling.
He lifts the smallest girl.
Wait,
Livy leafs the pages of Grant's manuscript as Mark ushers the children into their bedroom. Mark carries one daughter in his arms.
Who's General Grant, Papa? Was he a Mississippi pilot?
Well, he's more like a woolly bear.
Come on, Clara. Papa's going to tell us a story.
About a woolly bear?
Yes, dear.
The girls listen.
Once... there was a woolly bear, and he lived in a wonderful woods full of lollipop bushes and all kinds of little animals. And one day, the woods caught fire.
And what did the bear do?
Well, he saw all the other little animals running away, so he started to run, too. But he looked around.
Livy enters.
And suddenly, he turned and he ran right at the fire.
Youth, if you're trying to give those babies nightmares again...
It's all right, Mama. We never believe Papa's story.
Go on, Papa.
Well, he ran right straight in the fire, and he began to spank it. And he
just flew around that woods, batting that old fire right to pieces.
What happened?
He saved the whole thing.
Did you see him, Papa?
Oh, yes. Yes, I saw him. And then after a while, it was winter, all cold and snow. And in all the woods, there wasn't one warm home for that old woolly bear. So he went away, because woolly bears don't know how to beg from anyone. And he walked far off, very slowly, on his old hurt paws. And he laid down in the snow, all alone, a dying old bear. Nobody remembering or caring about him anymore.
Poor old woolly bear. Did he die, Papa?
Not yet, darling. And we can't let him.
Livy beams from across the room. Now, a headline reads, Mark Twain to publish Grant memoirs.
Mark, you're insane. I warn you, this will bring about your absolute ruin.
I saw Grant ride into Washington at the head of 50,000 men.
But all that isn't on your shoulders, Mark.
But there are other publishers. When we turn our back on men like that, we're changing ourselves into something cowardly, weak, and mean. It takes all the dignity out of humanity. Leaves us nothing but shame for what we are.
Now, Mark takes a copy from the shelf.
Millions of children yet unborn will know and realize your greatness.
That's the sincerest tribute that has ever been paid to any man.
Now, as Mark writes, unpaid bills float by.
If you do this one thing more, I can never get you out. You'll be writing for the rest of your life just to pay off your debts, with bankruptcy staring you in the face.
Headlines, General Grant dead, and Grant memoirs in fourth edition. Mark signs a check to Mrs. Julia D. Grant. More headlines, typesetter fails, Twain Publishing House reported in difficulties. Another reads, Mark Twain in bankruptcy. Now, Pond throws down a newspaper in Twain's office.
Mark, it's impossible for me to conceive how a man of your superb ability has ended up in such a hopeless position.
Maybe it's because I have a greater genius for getting myself into the worst possible fixes than any man that ever lived.
You made a fortune for General Grant's widow. What did you get out of it?
Mark stands.
Satisfaction.
Mrs. Grant, hundreds of your friends throughout the country have offered you their assistance. Why won't you let us help you?
Once down on the Mississippi, there's a big flood. An old darky standing on the shore saw a cat floating by in a chicken coop. And that cat was a friend of his. So he got himself a pole and tried to pull it ashore. Do you know what happened to the darky?
What?
He fell in himself. After a while, that cat just jumped ashore.
Mark, do you think you can ever jump ashore from this chicken coop?
Rogers enters.
Gentlemen, I just come from the creditors' meeting.
Yes?
We reached an agreement. I convinced them that they couldn't expect more than 50 cents on the dollar.
50 cents on the dollar? I won't accept it.
I'm warning you.
Well, all I can do...
Go back and tell them I won't accept it.
Will you listen
Mark,
to us?
Please.
Go back and tell them it's not good enough. I'll pay them every penny I owe.
Of course, we know that's what you'd like, Mark, but do you realize your debt amounts to almost $250,000?
It's utterly impossible.
Gentlemen, once when I wanted a frog, I went right out where the frogs were, and I got one. There have always been a lot of foolish people in this world actually willing to pay money to hear me speak. So I'm going on a lecture tour. First, across the United States to the West Coast. Then across the Pacific to Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand, China, India, Africa. I'll speak in every principal city in this infernal globe. I'll talk around the world as long as anybody will listen.
Around the world? Mark, do you realize what a plan like this means at your age, night after night, month after month, traveling, talking?
Why, it's beyond anyone's physical endurance.
You know of an easy way to earn $250,000?
But Africa.
Well, I guess I can stand it if Africa can. What's the matter? Don't you think I'd be funny and hot and tot? Why, the common flea has been all these places. You want me to be beaten out by a flea? I'll talk wherever six people will gather together at a crossroads, and I'm going to flabbergast those creditors.
Well, great heavens, if you can do this, Mark, you'll be the most famous man in the world, and me the richest.
Can't we fix it to make you the most famous and... me, the richest?
Now, at a train station.
There's Mark Twain. Hi, Mark. You got Huck Finn with you?
Good luck, Mark.
Hey, Mark. You're the prince and I'm the pauper.
He pats one of his bags.
I'll be carrying this one.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Now, what are you all sniffling about? Can't a man go away once in his life without being cried over?
You're crying yourself, Papa.
I am not.
Papa, please take care of yourself.
Now, look here, Claire. Am I raising a daughter or are you raising me?
Well, I'm raising you. Somebody has to.
She sobs on Libby's shoulder.
Don't worry about me. I came into this world with Halley's Comet, and I'm going to stay here till it comes back for me. That won't be for a long time, I hope.
All aboard!
Livy stops him.
Oh, Mark, I want to go with you.
Oh, now don't start that again, Livy. It's only because you'll be here with the girls that I can go.
Mark, come on!
All right.
Oh, youth, I want so to go with you.
Now, Livy, it'll do you good being shut of me for a while after all these years. And don't forget, you're coming over just as soon as the girls are off to school.
All aboard!
Goodbye, dear.
Goodbye, Papa.
Susie.
Goodbye, Papa.
Clara.
He kisses the girls goodbye.
Please take care of yourself.
All aboard!
Take care of yourself. That's more important.
Goodbye, Papa.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Papa. Goodbye, Papa. Goodbye, you.
She drops her head.
Goodbye.
Mother, you were wonderful. Papa didn't have the least idea you weren't feeling well.
Livy smiles bravely. Now, Mark's train speeds down a track. An audience is filled with laughing people as Mark stands before them on stage.
You know, there's been a great to-do over Adam as the inventor of sin. Why, it was nothing at all. I could have done it myself.
The laughing audience fades to a train wheel on a track, then, on a relief map, San Francisco. Now an ocean liner crosses the Pacific and a map shows Sydney, Australia. Now, in an elegant hall, Mark stands at a banquet table surrounded by a room full of diners.
Ladies and gentlemen, in the United States, we refer to Australia as the other side of the world. But I must say, now that I'm here, it feels just as right side up as the other side.
Men and women in fancy dress laugh. Now the map moves from Australia to India. In the city of Allahabad, a man in a loincloth and turban walks a pair of oxen. An elephant passes, draped with a banner. Tonight at Rajput Salah, ha ha, Mark Twain. The elephant moves on, revealing Mark at a sidewalk cafe. Pond sits down.
I have a cable here from Rogers.
Oh. Mark, you have a long way to go.
Mark rolls his eyes.
Mark Twain, ha ha.
Now, thousands fill a sunlit plaza. Mark lectures from under a canopy.
In my travels around the world, I have been impressed by one fact more than any other. The universal brotherhood of man is our most precious possession. What there is of it. The trouble with the human race is the human race.
Now, in Missouri, Mark speaks from a pulpit with a bell-shaped dome and pointed spire.
Concerning the difference between man and the jackass, some observers hold that there isn't any. But this wrongs the jackass. In fact, speaking of animals, I have often thought that God probably created the monkey because he was disappointed in man.
In the audience, two turbaned men turn to each other and laugh. Now, glistening white caps fade as the map becomes a globe. From India, we move over to Arabia, then on to France and Spain. Now, over England, we stop at London. A man descends a staircase to Mark, who speaks to a group of fancy-dressed people.
I say, I have a cablegram from America. It says Mark Twain is dead.
Mark faces him.
Oh, I say, this is rotten luck.
What's the matter, young man?
Well, it's rather awkward, sir. You see, Mr. Twain, I get paid by the word, and they don't want an item unless you're dead. And I had counted on at least 500 words.
Well, I tell you what you do. You cable him 1,000 words, saying,
He draws a cigar and muses.
Oh, just say the report of my death,
He lights the cigar.
Has been greatly exaggerated.
Greatly exaggerated. Well, it is, isn't it? Oh, yes, of course.
Now, an audience applauds. Mark stands before the huge brass pipes of a church organ.
Ladies and gentlemen, William Shakespeare, probably the greatest man of English letters, is dead. John Keats, one of our finest poets,
is dead.
The audience exchanges confused looks.
And I feel far from well myself.
The audience turns to each other and laughs. Now, Mark paces on a ship's deck as he talks with Pond.
Sometimes I don't see how I can cook up one more silly remark. I'm spark dry. I've still got to disillusion Paris and Brussels, Amsterdam, Munich.
Mark, what would be the best news I could give you?
That I'd never have to face another audience as long as I live.
Well, two more lectures and you won't have to. You'll have paid every cent you owe.
I won't have to be comical in Dutch.
No.
Mark shakes his head, then perks up.
I can join Livy in Florence.
Pond nods.
I'm glad I had her wait for me there. She never could have stood it.
Mark, you've done it.
Of course I've done it. Pond always, for every moment, I have held the unwavering belief that this thing was utterly impossible.
Now, in Italy, a hand holds a letter addressed to Mrs. Samuel L. Clemens.
Buongiorno, una lettera da Londra.
Grazie. Mrs. Clemens, it is a letter from Mr. Clemens.
A nurse brings Livy the letter.
Oh, he's coming. I know he's coming very soon.
Bundled in a wheelchair, Livy reads the letter.
And right now, I don't want to do anything in this lopsided world but join you at Florence. No boat is fast enough, no train is speedy enough to bring me to you.
The nurse pours a tonic.
Good night, dear heart. Sweet dreams. Mark.
You take this now. It will make you rest.
The nurse's hand steadies Livy's as she drinks the tonic.
It seemed impossible, but he had so much courage.
The nurse sets down the glass and steps behind the wheelchair.
We will go in now. You will sleep a little, maybe, huh?
Later, in a tree, a pair of doves jut their heads and peer at a hand-painted sign reading, Notice to Birds, Please Don't Sing Too Loud, Livy Sleeping. And in parenthesis, baritones come back later. Mark, in a white vested suit, posts the sign.
I thought maybe she'd see it when she woke and maybe make her smile.
Oh, she'll love it. You know, Mark, I think...
Mark ushers Pond away. Now, Livy reads a letter.
Mark! Mark!
Yes, dear?
Mark, come quickly.
Mark rushes through the French doors to her bedroom.
Livy, what? Are you all right? Livy, what happened?
He approaches the bed.
Well, you look like you'd seen an angel.
Mark, what would it take to make you think you're a pretty good writer?
Well, I did kind of set out to be. Only the paper gave out.
You see, I've known it for a long time. I've known it all our life together.
Livy, dearest, you make me feel I could count on one vote.
He lights candles.
Even if I ran on a Republican ticket.
Of course, the people always knew it. They loved you from the very first.
Well, you know, that's like our babies. They always liked me best when I stood on my head.
He sits by her side.
You struggled so hard to be something else. To get away from the wonderful thing you are. But darling, that very struggle you made wrote your name in the everlasting stars.
She picks up the letter on the bed.
This is from Oxford University, Mark.
She hands it to him.
They've sent for you.
He holds it near the light.
You ought to be given the same honorary degree as was given Wordsworth and Macaulay and Robert Browning.
Livy gazes proudly at Mark.
The name of Mark Twain is with them now. There isn't any higher honor, Mark.
His gaze moves from the letter to her.
Livy, do you really think that...
With all my heart.
Mark slides up her lacy nightgown cuff and kisses her hand. His eyes rise to meet hers.
And now, dear, promise me one thing.
He nods.
You must go to Oxford, even if I can't be there. And stand where those other great have stood. For me.
He quickly nods.
Yeah, I promise, Libby.
Soft candlelight falls on the gray-haired couple.
I don't think any woman is ever been as happy as I am tonight.
Livy smiles faintly, then faces Mark and takes his hand.
Now, Mark, will you sing to me a little while?
He nods slightly.
While I go to sleep.
He pats her hand and stands to leave. Now, he sits at the piano in the next room.
Swing low, sweet chariot, come for to carry me home.
Livy watches from her bed.
Swing low, sweet chariot.
As Mark plays the ornate grand piano, Livy's candles burn lower. The piano's open lid casts a tall shadow on the bare wall.
I looked over Jordan, what did I see? Come for to carry me home. A band of angels coming after me.
The letter slips from
come
Livy's hand.
For to carry me.
Flame of the candelabra's shortest candle goes out.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for a carry.
Pawn's shadow approaches on the wall.
You can stop now, Mark, I think.
Mark lowers his head as Pawn gives him a comforting pat on the shoulder. Mark raises his hollowed eyes skyward. Now, in moonlight, a long pool reflects a colonnade of statues and spire-shaped trees. Mark stands with Pawn.
It's so beautiful, I can't believe she doesn't see it.
Pawn looks over at his grieving friend.
I can't go back to America right away. Something I promised her to do.
I'll see that everything's taken care of, Mark.
I want you to have this carved on the stone for her resting place in Elmira. I couldn't write anything myself.
He turns away.
Warm summer sun, shine kindly here. Warm southern wind, blow softly here. Green sod above, I like. Good night, dear heart. Good night. Good night.
A title appears. Oxford over the towering university buildings. Now iron bells swing in a tower and a scrolled plaque reads, Ye Oxford Roll of Honor. Here stand inscribed the names of those Oxford has honored that their lives may honor her. Below the inscription, names on the plaque read, Benjamin Disraeli, Robert Browning, Alfred Tennyson, William Wordsworth, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Thomas Babington Macaulay, and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Now Mark Twain's shadow falls across the plaque. He stands erect while Pond adjusts his scholar's gown over his black suit. Then Pond escorts him down the corridor where he joins other men in similar attire. Now, four men in black robes lead a procession through a pair of heavy wooden doors as two ushers at the entry swing the doors open. Inside, scholars rise as the group of honorees enter the auditorium. The men file down an aisle in pairs. Hundreds of men in robes and women in long dresses fill the tiered seats of the hall. As the procession of smiling honorees file past, the audience waves. Mark nods to the crowd as he walks along. In an upper tier, next to Pond, a blonde youth calls out.
I say, did you bring your jumping frog with you?
Pond laughs. Mark smiles up at the boys and waves.
This is much better than roughing it, isn't it? I say, how's having a very kid?
Now the chancellor, in a caped robe, hands a scroll to a balding, bespectacled man.
And so, Rudyard Kipling, I conferred on you the degree Doctoris Literarum.
Kipling gives a quick bow and walks from the podium. The chancellor and two flanking deans don their flat mortarboards, then remove them as the chancellor reads.
Samuel Langhorne Clemens, Mark Twain.
Mark gathers up his robe and briskly climbs the steps to the podium. Grins and broad smiles fill the onlookers' faces. The chancellor's smiling eyes fix on Mark.
Most amiable and charming, sir. You shake the sides of the whole world with your merriment.
He turns to the crowd.
In the heart of the American continent, a great river, the magnificent Mississippi, gave its lifeblood to a young nation throughout its early days. The part played by that river in world history is now done. But through the writings of this single man, the river flows on, a part of our own lives, forever. Yet he has done more than bring a river to our hearts. Through humble human scenes, through glimpses of barefooted men and bewildered boys, he has preserved to us our finest record of a great nation as it came of age.
Pond watches
teary-eyed. A record that stands imperishable and irreplaceable, like the pyramids of Egypt, immortalizing a stirring age. He has given us even more. He has made it impossible for any man ever again to mistrust the soil in which his own life found root, or to doubt that he himself may draw from it all greatness, wherever that soil may be. He has taught us that it is through the laughter and tears of humble folk that a nation's story may be most truly told. All this, we, the people of England, nay, the peoples of all nations, owe to Mark Twain.
Now, spectators let loose streamers as an ocean liner docks. In the New York Register, a headline reads, Twain in triumphant return to America. Another headline reads, Yale University honors Mark Twain. And another, Twain birthday dinner at Delmonico's. Now, hundreds of guests sit at long banquet tables. Then, another headline, Mark Twain rests at Stromfield. In his bed, Twain lights a pipe. A doctor takes his pulse.
You know, Quintard, it beats me. I suppose man is the only living animal who never knows where he's at. You take the cat that sat on the hot stove lid. She didn't have any perspective or time to think. But she knew instinctively, that cat, what she had done.
He draws a puff from his pipe.
She got up at once.
Quintard takes his pipe.
Yeah, I have to run now, Mark.
Can't you sit and smoke just one, Manila?
No.
These are better than I usually offer you.
And neither can you.
Quintard takes away the cigar.
I look at the reports now, Clara.
They're in the study, Doctor.
Mark retrieves his pipe. Clara, now an adult, spreads a blanket over the bed. Propped against a pillow, Mark writes.
You don't need to do that now, Father.
She takes his notebook.
Yes, force of habit, I suppose.
She takes away his pipe.
Where's my cat?
Well, she's busy. She'll explain to you later.
Clara gathers scattered pages.
It was only a few minutes ago that that cat was a kitten. Now she's 15 cats.
20 cats? That's what she's busy with.
Clara pulls up the blanket.
Sometimes I feel like a stalk of corn, left standing all alone in the field.
Clara tucks the pillow. Mark stares off as Clara leaves.
There's nobody left for me to play with anymore.
Mark takes a manuscript from his bedside and begins to read. Clara tidies up, walks to a pair of windows, and pushes one open. She takes a breath of night air and looks out at the sky. As her gaze rises, her eyes suddenly widen and her jaw drops.
Dr. Quintard! Dr. Quintard!
The doctor returns to the bedroom, buttoning his cufflink. He goes to Clara's side. He swings open the other window and peers out. A blazing comet hangs in the starry sky. Clara and Quintard gaze up at it. The doctor turns toward Mark's bed. Clara's eyes slowly float after him. Her face tightens. Clenching her hands together against her stomach, she approaches her father's bed. The doctor steps toward her. Mark lies peacefully on the bed, a sheet of paper in his lap. The doctor gently pats her shoulder, then leaves the room. Now, a specter of Mark in his white suit appears behind Clara. He reaches out to her. The ghostly Mark looks up.
Sam! Sam! Here we are!
A tiny ghost-like Tom and Huck sit on a fence.
Come on.
Mark looks back at his weeping daughter.
Oh, my darling, if you could only know, what you look upon as my death has been greatly exaggerated.
Tom and Huck wave to him. The ghostly Mark walks towards the boys, leaving the lifeless Mark on the bed. As the phantom barefoot boys run down the grassy hill, Tom's hound on a leash follows. Huck carries his fishing pole. Mark Twain meets them, and Tom and Huck take his hands. They merrily tramp up a dirt road. As they head up the hill, the horizon glows with brilliant rays of sunlight. Mark and his companions approach the crest of the hill where the bright light silhouettes their figures, then disappear as they descend on the far side. Then, over the still image of a Mississippi steamboat, words appear. The end. Beneath them, a Warner Brothers First National picture. Fade to black.